TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Helena Norberg Hodge, Big Picture Activism. Local Futures, also known as Economics of Happiness, is an organization founded by Helena Norberg Hodge. They are pioneers of the new economy movement that is dedicated to the renewal of community, ecological health, and local economies worldwide. In July 2017, Helena Norberg Hodge spoke at Schumacher College in England. She began her Earth Talk by recalling the experience that changed her life, her visit to the remote region of Ladakh in northern India. Ladakh had escaped colonial domination until the late 1970s. In 1975, Helena Norberg Hodge found an almost intact traditional culture. But by the late 1980s, Ladakhi culture had been dramatically changed and many of their values destroyed, not by war or slavery, but by the introduction of globalized trade and consumerism. Here is Helena Norberg Hodge.
I had come out as part of a film team. I wasn't planning to stay for more than 6 weeks to help make a film. As a linguist, I'd been asked to both help with the sound of the film, but also to pick up a bit of the language. Well, in those 6 weeks, I just totally fell in love with the people. I had never, ever encountered people who seemed so vital, so full of joy. And so when the filming was finished, I stayed on. And I ended up doing research and doing a basic dictionary of English Ladakhi. The spoken Ladakhi was sort of a modern form of Tibetan, and that had not been written down before. I went through the whole region with these relatively small villages and one capital city. I never, ever saw any sign of hunger. I never heard people complain about being undeveloped or poor. In fact, people would say to me, oh, you must stay in the winter. That's the best time of the year, because then we just have festivals, you know, in the summer. You know, there's quite a lot of farming work. Now, I saw over a 10-year period how that incredible self-respect and their whole attitude to themselves changed because of what we call development. In came tourists. And in came ideas about a Western life that looked like it was a complete paradise. It looked like we do no work. Because when tourists came to Ladakh in the early days, spending $100 a day was roughly the sum that a Ladakhi family might have in a year. In the early contrast between a culture where water, food, housing, medical care, basically everything you really needed was without money. So money was only for luxuries. And in fact, their money at that time was traditionally had been more in the form of stones, turquoise, coral, pearls, gold. And the women had most of that jewelry. But Western anthropologists were coming in. And I realized over the years that partly what they were doing, of course, was judging the culture by Western yardsticks, and they'd see that men and women sat separately at public functions, at weddings and so on. And that seemed to them like women, didn't have the same power as men do. It was also the men who went out and traded, who traveled much further away. The women tended not to go such long distances. But I would say, having grown up in Sweden, that in Ladakh, the status of women, the status of the feminine, was higher than in Sweden. In Sweden, probably out of the entire industrialized world, women and the feminine have a higher status. And I still say that over the years, what I came to discover was that the structures, the whole way of life, made women and the feminine empowered that so much more. Now, it was a whole series of things. You know, one of them was that because they lived in intergenerational communities every mother had roughly 10 caretakers for every baby. When you have that situation, if a child is ill or, you know, if there's a problem, no one gets tired or irritable or, you know, it's so easy. And that, of course, affects the child hugely. Now, I don't want to say this to make anyone feel bad or guilty for having grown up in or living in a typical Western context. But what I'm trying to promote is a vision of a more localized economic structure that could help us all regain many of the basic wealth of a culture like that. You know, we can't go back to living like the Ladakhis, but there are certain principles that are very important. And one of them is much more community contact and much more contact between generations. Also in Ladakh, when schools were brought in, which weren't there before, that when you put children age one in a room all day, you're creating a universe of competition and elbows. You cannot reach out a hand as a one-year-old and help the other child walk. You're physically incapable of that. Now, what happens, and I saw it out there, is that when children are mixed of different ages and with adults and in constant interaction, there's a natural process of learning and teaching that is lifelong. The modern day schooling that we have was brought in together with industrial production and to train up a workforce. In Ladakh, it was so clear that when children had gone through schooling, they had been trained for a job in the urban sector. In other words, in a sector based on fossil fuels and materials which were not available in Ladakh. They learned nothing about food production, nothing about building a house, nothing about providing at all for basic needs. Later on, if they became specialized and went to agricultural college, then they would learn about a few pesticides and hybridized seeds and hybridized animals that were meant to be appropriate for Ladakh. And I saw how on the radio, you know, people were starting, the agricultural experts as part of development were promoting, among other things, DDT and other pesticides that were outlawed in the West. I also saw that with animals, the experts were bringing in Jersey cows. Now, in Ladakh, the grazing land was up at about 18,000 feet. I mean, you had to certainly go over passes of about 18,000 feet to get there. You had a very well adapted cow and a mixture of the yak and the cow called a dzo, that were able not only to go up to those high pastures, but they spent months, they were sort of semi-wild. It was lovely, lovely to see them because they really were their own masters. And then at the time of harvest, they would come wandering down, and sometimes they go off to another valley and you meet people who were running, you know, looking for their yak or their dzo. And they sometimes decided to come down too early and then they had to be escorted back up again. But bringing in Jersey cows, what did that mean? It meant bringing in industrial pellets, importing the pellets to feed them. And then, yes, they gave more liters a day than the typical local cow or yak, but nothing like the same nutritional quality of what these animals had from up. This is just one small example of what's happening with a monocultural development model based on fossil fuels, based on forms of production that are simply not compatible with the needs of the earth, with the biodiversity of the earth, and that are not compatible with different cultures. I just want to say something also about the psychological impact of the outside culture coming in, which came in through schooling, through radio, at first there wasn't television, and advertising, tourism, and development experts, most of them Indian, coming in. The message was, your culture is backward and primitive. You've got to do everything you can to become as Western as possible. And for the boys, the image was Rambo. It was so clear how these role models polarized and made a joke of gender roles. For the girls, it was literally Barbie doll. Blonde, blue-eyed Barbie dolls. And I saw women who previously had been strong and able to do things and respected for their abilities in the economy suddenly become so self-conscious and so passive. And I saw that depression, particularly among women, started coming in. I saw that with the young men, what started happening is that here they were being trained to be this modern Western man in this modern economy, and that meant earning money, and the jobs were very scarce. So almost overnight, by creating a scarcity of jobs, by creating unemployment, this modern economy created conflict and competition between people. So what emerged was a conflict between Buddhists and Muslims to start with. And it was clear that when you rob men of their self-respect as their identity, to be who they are, and then you rob them of the ability to provide for themselves and their family, it's a recipe for violence. And it's a violence that will also mean turning against your own community, your women in your community, children in your community. It's just a terrible way to run a society, to run an economy. So what happened is literally that by 89, there was violent bloodshed between Buddhists and Muslims. It was very traumatic. And I had already before that been so passionate about trying to say to people, wake up, wake up. This economic development model we have is simply not working for human needs. This tyranny of monocultural images affects all of us. I want to say that also as an invitation as to why I believe that big picture activism has this huge potential to bring us all together across racial divides, across cultural divides, across left and right politics, across, you know, grassroots to the top of business and government. We all, if we see the big picture, we will all have a reason to join in a systemic transformation of the economy. I have become convinced that we need to look at the way that our economic system goes back to a trajectory which really started with very big, wealthy business leaders. I mean, you know, it started with the kings and the rich sending traders off across the world. I mean, traders is not the right word. In the beginning, they were robbers. They were going to rob people of their wealth. And from having seen this economic transformation in Ladakh, and also later I worked in Bhutan between 84 and 89, and I saw exactly parallel changes to Ladakh. And again, people would say to us, this is our story too. The story you tell is what happened here. So it's very clear that we have not been aware of the fundamental structures of this economy and how it has its roots in colonialism and slavery. When traders were able to set up a situation where you had poor people over here and rich people over here, the global traders were able to amass more and more wealth and power. This process led to the birth of these giant corporations. Part of this system, too, is banking and what happened to banking and who has the right to make money. I'll come back to that. So this system really has continued unabated, but we haven't been paying attention to it, particularly in the last 30 years. So by the mid-80s, what had happened was we were no longer talking about the power of corporations. Basically, what we have seen in my network is that this process of trade treaties, which is really what globalization is, it's a process of agreements between countries and multinationals. And those multinationals are pressuring our governments to give them more and more freedom. The right to go in and out of national economies without any rules, without any constraints. And there are even clauses in the treaties now that say, if you do anything that might risk my making potential profit out of your country, I have the right to sue you. And so countries are signing in black and white, yes, you can sue us. So I just want to summarize by saying that I feel very optimistic now. You know, no guarantees or anything, but I feel very optimistic that it is totally possible that we will see a major wake-up to the central reason behind climate change, unemployment, and particularly those two are so important. Because at the moment, people are being led to believe that they, either it's their jobs or it's the environment. And they're voting for Trump and other leaders who are taking us in a disastrous direction. But behind unemployment, as well as climate change, as well as the extinction of species, as well as an epidemic of depression and anxiety, particularly among young people, the loss of democracy. And even if people don't see the loss of democracy, most of you will recognize that more and more governments are having a very difficult time creating a government. The instability and the swings are greater and greater throughout the world, in every country that I know of. Why? It goes back to the fact that the real government has become these businesses behind the scenes. Now, I am really seeing that everywhere you go, more people are waking up to that systemic root cause behind the instability, the poverty, the environmental problems. Beginning to see we must make an economic shift. We need rules. We need to regulate instead of deregulating. Now, the re-regulation is only going to happen through international collaboration. So in what we call big picture activism, we are talking about connecting with like-minded people as the number one thing. So we talk about connect, educate, resist, renew, and celebrate. And what we mean by connect is don't go at this alone. Try to find even one or two like-minded people near where you live. Try to meet regularly. If you can't meet them near where you live, then maybe connect with some of people on the internet who share your thinking and have some Skype meetings now and then. When you change the I to a we, you open up a very different avenue of thinking. You suddenly have more power. You suddenly are thinking differently. The next thing is to educate, and it starts by educating ourselves. There are so many layers of assumptions now. I mean, one of them has been that poor countries shouldn't need to lower their CO2 emissions. The rich countries should be lowering their CO2 emissions right now. It's a completely corporate agenda. The corporations, through globalization and trade treaties, were moving to where labor was cheap. They needed to have dirty, polluting factories in China, in Vietnam, in India. So to then have Western environmentalists campaign saying that poor countries shouldn't need to reduce their CO2 emissions, it's all been because of a lack of the big picture. If we understood globalization and the big picture, we would not be lobbying for the people in the poor countries to have more pollution and to have big factories where they have more or less slave-like conditions. We would be understanding that worldwide we would be better off strengthening local economies, shortening distances, and particularly around food. So the localizing path is what I call renewal. The resistance part is resisting the escalation of the juggernaut, resisting particularly the more trade treaties, and part of that resistance needs to lead to a political shift towards regulating global banks and corporations. Now, on the other side, the renewal is already happening all around the world. Everywhere you look, you will see the most inspiring and heartwarming changes that absolutely affirm that human beings are not greedy and aggressive by nature. For me, this is the most important message maybe that I have. Don't allow yourself to be told that, oh, the human race, you know, we're just like a cancer. We deserve to extinguish ourselves. I hear people saying that these days. Please don't fall into that trap. And please just look, you know, at any little child you can see and know that all of us are born longing to be loved. And if we get that little bit of love, we're usually going to be quite loving people. And love is a very, very important driver. But the most important movement that I see worldwide that is so fundamental is the local food movement. And it is a global local food movement. But again, we've not been allowed to see it because it should be spelled out as the systemic and incredibly healing movement that it is. And we should be learning about all these initiatives around the world that are demonstrating that small, diversified farms are much more productive than large monocultures can ever be, ever. So structurally, we must move towards diversification, and it's happening around the world. They're proving that it's more productive and it's more job rich. So people have more meaningful work, and there's a whole new farmers movement emerging where young people are wanting to farm. They don't want to stand in a monoculture being told by a satellite and computer what to do, you know, bending over all day like a machine. That type of agriculture, which also grew up with a type of slave-like economic condition, and where even now we have migrant labor behaving like machines, that image is what is fed to us to make us think that, of course, we must have more and more technology to replace people. In actual fact, when you see what artisan production looks like, particularly in food and farming, but even in things like pottery, house building, many community localized small-scale forms of providing all our basic needs are much more satisfying, use much less energy, are much less polluting. The only reason we can't do that is because of an economic system that's imprisoning us. You know, we need to see our way out of it. The shift in subsidies away from encouraging every business to use more energy and technology and dump people. That's what we're doing right now as a system, worldwide. More energy, more technology, we subsidize that. We subsidize it from university, even in the schooling, that's what you're trained up for. If we shifted that to support really full employment and small-scale, flourishing economies for basic needs. Basically, we want to look at a world where society shapes business rather than business shaping society. Now, society shaping business means that you and I need to be informed about how money is made. Right now, it's a sham. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's absolutely criminal that a few financial institutions can make money out of thin air and then spin it around in this casino-like speculative system, you know, literally controlling the value of our currency, of our water, of our clothes, of our democracy, and of our ideas. if you learn about the incredible benefits of localizing, of renewing, of regenerating, restoring ecosystems, restoring the community fabric, mental health, there's so many wonderful, wonderful projects out there. So the final word is to celebrate. And that is to remind ourselves also in a whole embodied contemplative way, allow ourselves to shut out the chattering mind that thinks about the climate change and Trump and all kinds of things that don't make us happy, to just allow ourselves to become calm and embodied and full of joy. Joy at everything that is still working so well. And it can just be reflecting on the miracle of the living world. So appreciating that beauty and that wholeness, that health, and how much is still working and beautiful is vitally important. And we urge in the celebration that we also bring back the sort of celebration that we had for our entire evolution until this modern, rather destructive economy. We used to be much more participatory. We developed many more skills. We were able to make things with our hands. We were able to do, some carpentry, some pottery. We had broad range of skills. And one of maybe the most important was singing, dancing, and making music. Very simple line dancing, Sufi dancing, the sort of thing that we did throughout our whole history. And that's incredibly enjoyable. So celebrate is a central part of rebuilding the local fabric, the participatory fabric, the local economy from the bottom up. And it really is an economics of happiness. Thank you.
That was Helena Norberg-Hodge. She spoke on July 26, 2017 at Schumacher College in England. Helena Norberg-Hodge is a pioneer of the New Economy movement and recipient of the Right Livelihood Award. Her book, Ancient Futures, describes the Ladakh experience and has been translated into more than 35 languages. She is the producer of the award-winning documentary, The Economics of Happiness, and director of Local Futures. Thanks to Schumacher College for this recording. You can see the 50-minute video of this talk on YouTube. This college was inspired by E.F. Schumacher, the economist, environmentalist, and author of Small is Beautiful. Visit the website for Local Futures for dates of upcoming conferences and workshops. That's www.localfutures.org. You can find links on the website for this radio program, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. And you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glöden. Thank you for listening.